They're right. going to,
yeah.
and we'll have to see.
Yeah, that's all the time we have for this week. Thanks to Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, and Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. This program is produced by VOA's Carol Castiel. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites, and I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.
VOA, the science edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Hello and welcome to the science edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. This is an encore presentation of our program that originally aired this past February. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, measles was eradicated in the United States at the turn of the 21st century. An outbreak of the highly infectious and potentially deadly disease in the Pacific Northwest state of Washington is so serious that the governor and public health officials there declared a state of emergency. Many health professionals point out that most of the recently reported measles cases are those who have not been vaccinated. A number of them have been pointing a finger of blame for the alarming outbreak on people involved with the so-called vaccination resistance or anti-vax movement. People who are part of this, mostly grassroots movement, are refusing to vaccinate their children against diseases such as measles, mumps, and rubella. Most cite concerns about health risks, such as autism, that they associate with modern vaccines. Others shun vaccines for religious or even philosophical reasons. Today, we'll take a look at these recent measles outbreaks and the dangers they pose to the public. We'll learn about the vaccine resistance or anti-vax movement and the reasoning behind their choice of not getting their children and themselves vaccinated. And we'll talk about vaccine safety and the concerns the medical community has with those who avoid or completely spurn vaccinations. Today's program is divided into two segments, each which features a guest speaking on behalf of the opposing sides of what has become a very controversial issue. Our guests for today's program are physician, university professor, and vaccinologist Dr. Peter Hotez, M.D., and Christina Hildegard, founder of A Voice for Choice, an education and advocacy organization that, according to their website, promotes people's rights to be fully informed about the composition, quality, and short- and long-term health effects of food and pharmaceutical products. We begin our conversation with Christina Hildegard. Christina, I guess the first thing I'd like to ask you is about vaccination choice. Is it vaccination choice, vaccination hesitancy, or, as others have been saying, the anti-vax movement? Do you consider your organization an anti-vax group?
It depends on the definition. I think you're absolutely right that there is a question of what is the definition. So the broad definition, anti-vax, is basically anybody who questions vaccines is sort of lumped into this category of anti-vax. So do we question vaccines? Yes, we question vaccines. Would I say we are anti-vax? No. We want every parent to have done the full research, make an informed choice about vaccines, and it's up to parents. So I think vaccine hesitancy is something that's sort of come around in the last year or two as a description. I think that is one end of the spectrum, probably. I think there are definitely people who are true anti-vax, you know, will not vaccinate, do not think vaccines are good. But I think there's a whole spectrum within that. And there's also the ex-vaxxers, who are people which I would say probably make up the majority of the quote-unquote anti-vaxxers, who are parents who have vaccinated, complied completely with their doctors, followed the schedule, and their children became vaccine injured and so have stopped vaccinating and have become this quote unquote anti-vaxxer, part of the anti-vaxxer group. So I think the anti-vax, I think it's used derogatorily, and I think it is used to lump a whole bunch of people in. The mass media likes to use it a lot, but I think there are a number of different groups or perceptions on vaccine that fall under that. And I think informed choice is probably a good word. I think most people, regardless of where you sit on the vaccine scale, whether you're pro-vax to all the way to anti-vax, I think, you know, most people can agree that they want informed choice, so that you have all the information at hand, and that they want it based on scientific research, and they want safe vaccines. So I think we can all come to an agreement on those three things, but we differ on our thresholds on those things, and we differ on what we believe the research and the informed choice to be.
Christina, you brought up a point that I'm now very curious about the people who did get their children vaccinated but had vaccination injuries. From what you've read, from what you've seen, how common is that?
I honestly don't think we know how common it is. I think it's much more common than we're led to believe. Statistics that you hear are 1 in 1 million. There's a 1 in 1 million chance of you getting injured by a vaccine. That number is actually that you either die or you have a permanent disability from vaccines. So the issue with vaccines and the reason why we don't have the numbers that are accurate is that you can't sue the vaccine manufacturers. There's no liability for vaccinations. And you have to go to a special court that was established in 1988, the Vaccine Compensation Program. And that court is a non-judgmental court. It basically, they have a list of the vaccines and what criteria you have in order to go to the court and get compensation. And those criteria are extremely small. So they're small in what could have happened to you. So you have to have either died or have had, you know, an anaphylactic reaction that resulted in permanent disability. It also has to have happened within a certain time period. So if it happened, some vaccines, it's within 6 weeks, some vaccines, it's happened within 2 weeks. So there's this very special criteria, and anybody outside of that. So for example, if my child has seizures after a vaccine, which is in all vaccine package inserts, that's a side effect that is listed on the package insert. If my child has seizures that are not permanently disabling, I can't go and sue the vaccine manufacturer for that, but yet they may have a permanent disability. So the number of parents that have children with vaccine injury, you know, I think is much, much greater. We know it's much greater than it's known. The reporting system, VAERS, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, is supposed to capture those adverse events by doctors inputting it or parents inputting the information. But the CDC itself has said that only, I think it's 10% of vaccine reactions are input into that database, which means that if you extrapolate that, there are actually millions of vaccine injuries happening every year. So we really don't have that number, but from parents anecdotally.
But when you're talking about an organization like the CDC or the FDA, don't they more or less rely on peer-reviewed research to make their findings?
I would recommend anybody who wants to look into that, sit in on an ACIP meeting. ACIP is the Commission for Immunization Practices, American Commission for Immunization Practices. And they're the ones that put the schedule together, the vaccine schedule. And when you sit in on those meetings, you'll realize how far from peer-reviewed research we are when they make these recommendations. And the similar with the FDA, who approves vaccines. Much of the research, I would say most of the research, is done by the pharmaceutical companies themselves. So Merck, Sanofi, GlaxoSmithKline, GSK, they do their own research, and that is what is put forward. So we know, and this has been, you know, it's been published in BMJ and British Medical Journal and other journals, that research that is done by the person selling a product is biased, usually cherry picked, you know, that kind of thing. The other research that is done that you'll find at places like ACIP, the meeting where they make the schedule, is research that's done by university organizations on very small sample sizes. So we're talking somewhere between 100 and 300 people at most. And that research, while it comes from a university setting, if you then go dig a little bit deeper, you'll see that the pharmaceutical industry pays for much of that research itself. So I would love more peer-reviewed research to be done and more independent research to be done. Unfortunately, that independent research has a very hard time finding its way to medical journals, to peer-reviewed medical journals, because the pharmaceutical industry also has their ties there. Pharmaceutical industry is the largest lobbying group in Washington, D.C. They spend a huge amount of money in Washington lobbying, and that affects the CDC. The CDC is a government arm, and the FDA is as well.
From what I understand and from what I've been reading, I understand that it takes up to 10 or more years of testing for all vaccines before they are licensed by the FDA. And then once they are, they're then monitored by the CDC and the FDA to make sure that the vaccines and the ingredients used in the vaccines are safe.
What's interesting about vaccines is they're a biological product. So they don't fall under the same guidelines as pharmaceutical products. So chemical products that are regular drugs, those have blind placebo tests. They have clinical trials, first stage, second stage, third stage clinical trials. Vaccines don't fall under that. Vaccines are biological products. So they can be implemented much more quickly with a lot less trials and a lot less rigor. Vaccines, most of the time, are tested against either the current vaccine on the market. So for example, the latest hepatitis B vaccine that came out was tested against the hepatitis B vaccine that's on the market, which was tested against a hepatitis B vaccine that was taken off the market. As long as you're comparable to the vaccine that's on the market, regardless of what that safety level is for that vaccine, you're good to go. The other thing that they will use is the full vaccine minus the virus. You know, if you asked me 10 years ago, what's in a vaccine, I would have said, oh, it's virus and probably, you know, some saline solution, you know, something that's not going to harm you. When you look at vaccine ingredients, they have aluminum in them. They used to have mercury. Some of the adult ones in the flu shot still have mercury in them. They have formaldehyde. They have polysorbate 80. They have a whole plethora of different chemical ingredients in them. You know, I don't think it's the virus necessarily that is causing the adverse reactions. I think it's the other stuff in the vaccine that's causing the adverse reactions. And there are studies that show that things like aluminum and other things are harmful in the vaccine. And so, again, we don't have this double-blind placebo test happening.
The WHO, the World Health Organization, is reporting an increase in measles outbreaks. New York State, Washington State are also reporting increases in measles cases.
Let's unpack what WHO says. Measles cases are increasing. Yes, they are. They are increasing in vaccinated populations as well as unvaccinated populations. So let's look at the statistics, and I don't have them on hand, but I would say to anybody who wants to delve deeper into this, look at the number of unvaccinated people that get measles versus vaccinated in the Western Hemisphere. The 100,000 deaths are not in the Western world. The Western world, if you look at the number of deaths there, they're a much, much smaller percentage. The number of deaths from measles are happening in places like Africa, where you don't have nutrition, you don't have clean water, you don't have clean sewers. If you look at the statistics, you know, in those people, if they didn't die from the measles, what would they have died of, kind of thing? How long was their life expectancy? You're playing with numbers, so to speak. Like, yes, I completely understand there are 100,000 deaths from measles, but those aren't happening in places where you have good healthcare. We haven't had a death in the U.S. from measles in 20 years. Look at the other things that are going on. When you put in nutrition, water, sewer systems, if you look at the statistics, and I would tell people the place where this is summarized the best is a book called Dissolving Illusions by Suzanne Humphreys. But she took all of the statistics for death and mortality from these diseases that had vaccines as well as ones that didn't, which are things like scarlet fever, typhoid. If you look at the statistics of the number of deaths of all of these diseases, they were close to zero before the vaccines were introduced. And it doesn't mean that they weren't measles outbreaks. Children were getting measles, but they weren't dying from it. If you're healthy, measles is a pretty benign childhood disease. When you look at the risk, and, you know, I say to every parent that comes to me and says, well, you know, should I be vaccinating? I don't know if I should be vaccinating. My answer is, look at the risk to benefit ratio. You know, for your child, 54% of our children in the U.S. are sick. When you have 54% of children sick in the U.S. and we have the highest vaccination rates, we have the highest level of glyphosate Roundup being used in our foods, pesticides, when you've got these toxins in our world, and we have 54% of our kids sick, that to me is the epidemic. It's not the measles or vaccine hesitancy. That's the epidemic.
Christina, I want to thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today, and I really appreciate your insights.
You're welcome. And, you know, if anybody has any additional information, our website is avoiceforchoice.org, and we're happy to share it. And I would say to everybody, do your research, do as much research on vaccines as you would a car seat, a crib, any of those things that you're buying for your baby, because you want to make an informed choice. And if you're making an informed choice, whatever that choice is the right choice for your family.
That was Christina Hildegard, founder of A Voice for Choice, an education and advocacy organization, which, according to their website, promotes people's rights to be fully informed about the composition, quality, and short and long-term health effects of food and pharmaceutical products. Let's take a break now. This is the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Here's a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download from our website, voanews.com/PCUSA, or from iTunes. Now, back to our program. Today we're talking about the so-called vaccination resistance or anti-vax movement, as well as why the medical community stresses the importance of getting vaccinated. In this segment, we'll talk about the concerns the medical community has with those who avoid vaccinations and why vaccinations are safe and important for staying healthy. My guest in this segment is Dr. Peter Hotez, MD, a pediatrician, dean for the National School of Tropical Medicine, and a professor at the Baylor College of Medicine, head of the Texas Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine Development in Houston, Texas, and an author. The doctor's latest book is Vaccines Did Not Cause Rachel's Autism, My Journey as a Vaccine Scientist, Pediatrician, and Autism Dad. Dr. Hotez, an outbreak of measles has been reported in about 10 U.S. states, and right now there's a serious outbreak in Washington state where public officials have declared a state of emergency. Can you bring us up to date on not only what's been going on up there in the Pacific Northwest, but in other states as well, such as Texas and New York?
So thanks for that. The lion's share of the epidemic is in Clark County, Washington, which is on the border with Oregon. And now we've just learned it's spreading into Portland, Oregon as well. So this is going to be a two-state epidemic. And that's not the only one. We're now seeing lots of cases pop up here in Texas. And their common denominator is the fact that they've had drops in vaccine coverage because the anti-vaccine movement is especially aggressive in those three states, in Washington, Oregon, and Texas, and filling parents with fears claiming that vaccines cause autism or cause intellectual disabilities. And, of course, there's enormous evidence showing that's not the case.
As you mentioned, a number of health officials, health professionals, are publicly blaming those who are part of the so-called vaccine resistance or anti-vax movement. And from what I've been reading, I understand that most of the areas impacted with these outbreaks have been described in the media as hotbeds of anti-vaxxers. What do they mean by hotbeds of anti-vaxxers? In other words, is this particular movement more popular in certain areas of the U.S. than others?
Certainly more effective in certain parts than others. So, for instance, of the 50 states, there are 18 states where the anti-vaccine lobby has persuaded the state legislators to allow vaccine exemptions for reasons of personal or philosophical belief. And that's where the battleground seems to be. Those 18 states are what we showed in the Public Library of Science last year, the places where we're seeing drops in vaccine coverage and therefore vulnerabilities to breakthrough childhood infectious diseases. And we tend to see measles more than the others because measles is the most contagious. So when you have a drop in vaccine coverage, measles is typically the first disease that we see break through. That's what we're seeing in this case. It's not only measles. We're seeing, unfortunately, unvaccinated children die from influenza. We're seeing teenage girls being deprived of their cervical cancer vaccine. So we're condemning them to a life of cervical cancer. But measles is certainly the most dramatic of the three.
So we're talking about, here in the United States, we're talking about what is commonly known as the MMR vaccine, measles, mumps, rubella. That seems to be the focal point of the whole movement, kicking off, I guess, the recent movement back in the late 90s.
Well, that's how it began. It began with a false claim that the MMR vaccine, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, led to what was then called pervasive developmental disorder, what we now call autism. And that was a paper published in the journal The Lancet. The results of that were shown to be invalid. There were accusations of fraud, and the paper was ultimately retracted after 12 years. But during that 12-year time, it kind of enabled the rise of this modern anti-vaccine movement, and we're now entering our third decade of it. So it began in 1998. 68. And back then, it was kind of a fringe movement, maybe a cult, but now it's become this massive anti-vaccine machine or ecosystem comprised of almost 500 anti-vaccine websites. So they've mastered the internet, all amplified on social media. And then we're now seeing the publication of phony books with misinformation, phony documentaries. We're also seeing now the rise of political action committees. So the movement has become politicized with raising money for candidates to run on anti-vaccine platforms. So it's become this well-oiled machine, and it's effective. It's a Pyrrhic victory, but it's effective in resulting in children being placed in harm's way, all because of this incredible misinformation campaign.
Doctor, how widespread is this movement? Is it basically restricted to the United States, or are other countries part of the movement as well?
Well, we're certainly seeing this play out in Europe as well. So, for instance, Italy has adopted this sort of Texas-style anti-vaccine movement using some of the similar language, phony terms like medical freedom or parental choice, when in fact children have a fundamental right to be protected against deadly infectious diseases. So it's playing out in Italy, France, Germany, Eastern Europe is a disaster, Romania, Ukraine. So this has gone beyond the U.S. It's in Europe. And my fear is that it could even start extending into places where we've made great progress over the last two decades because of the Gavi Alliance, the Global Alliance of Vaccines and Immunization in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And I worry we could start to see an unraveling of those gains as well.
I understand that, according to the CDC, that at least here in the United States, measles had been eradicated around the year 2000.
That's right. It was eliminated. It was a great public health triumph, and now it's come roaring back. And so I'm not sure we can even say measles is eliminated anymore. It certainly doesn't look that way today with measles outbreaks raging in Washington, Oregon, and Texas.
Why was this particular outbreak of measles declared a statewide emergency in Washington? What are the dangers to public health related to the situation?
Well, the dangers are particularly to infants under the age of 12 months who are not yet old enough to receive their measles vaccine. So when you get a large outbreak or epidemic like this with more than 50 cases, it's a problem because those infants under 12 months are the ones most vulnerable, and that's coupled with two other facts. One is measles, one of the most contagious infectious diseases known. On average, if a single individual gets measles, at least another dozen unvaccinated kids, again, infants under the age of 12 months, also get measles, and it's one of the most serious of the infections that we vaccinate against. So measles can cause measles pneumonia, measles encephalitis, that leads to permanent neurologic injury and deafness and other terrible things. So that's the reason for sounding the emergency alarm, and I think that was an appropriate thing to do. And the problem, of course, is once an epidemic starts, it's hard to contain because it is so highly contagious, and that's why we typically need 90-95% vaccine coverage because of the highly contagious nature of the measles virus.
So what is the public health community doing to mitigate the effects of this measles outbreak?
Well, in the short term, what you have to do is mount a vaccination campaign. So any child who's eligible to get vaccinated but so far has held out or their parents have held them out, they need to get vaccinated to protect them. And then you have to worry about the infants under 12 months of age. And so, unfortunately, that means many parents are going to have to avoid bringing their infants out in public places like the shopping mall or the public library. So I think ultimately they will get this under control, but after enormous labor and effort and expense, you know, to trace down all the contacts, trace where they're based, the hospitalization cost of infants, this will easily run into the millions of dollars. But then, assuming this all does get under control, then we have the bigger issue of how to prevent this from ever happening again. And this is pretty straightforward for many states that allow the non-medical vaccine exemptions. We have to close that loophole. And if we do that, we can succeed like what happened in California. So California had a horrific measles outbreak in 2014-2015 in Orange County. Dozens of kids were hospitalized. The California legislature said, you know what, we're not going to do this anymore, and they closed those non-medical vaccine exemptions. You still have the problem of some physicians writing phony medical exemptions, but I don't think that's going to turn into a major issue. But so I think the problem's mostly solved in California, and we have to now do the same in the 18 states that still allow this practice. So we have to stop it in Washington, Oregon. Texas is the largest state that allows these non-medical exemptions. And we have to do the same in the other 15 states.
Dr. Hotez, I was scanning Twitter today about looking at the anti-vax movement, the vaccine hesitancy movement, whatever it's being called. And I noticed that a number of these people involved with the movement are very passionate about it and are dead set in their beliefs about the dangers associated with vaccines and why they won't get themselves or their children vaccinated.
Yeah, and it's because of, as I've mentioned, the anti-vaccine movement has mastered the internet. So, again, by some accounts, almost 500 websites, all amplified on social media. So the pro-vaccine has lost that battle. And I'm not quite sure how we get it back again, other than trying to mount a vigorous pro-vaccine advocacy campaign. You know, the ones you're seeing on Twitter and often are the ones who are most dug in. That's probably not the majority of people. You know, most vaccine hesitant parents or their pediatricians I speak to tell me all they've heard is the misinformation. They've never heard the pro-vaccine side. And you can talk them off the ledge if you have the time to do it. But unfortunately, we don't seem to be doing that in this country.
I understand there are a number of motivating factors behind the anti-vax movement. Many people are concerned that vaccines aren't safe and they pose dangers to health, such as autism, for example. And they're concerned about certain ingredients in vaccines. And of course, one of the other issues is that a number of these people have no trust in pharmaceutical companies or regulatory agencies to ensure the safety of the vaccines.
Yeah, so let's unpack some of those things. So we now have massive evidence showing there's no link between vaccines and autism, also no plausibility, because we've learned so much about autism in the last few years, especially knowing now we've identified at least 99 genes that operate in early fetal development. The point is autism is set into motion during pregnancy well before kids ever see vaccines, so there's no plausibility. So that one we've got covered. Regarding the ingredients, these are extensively tested by the Food and Drug Administration. If this idea of toxic ingredients is a bit ridiculous because they are present in such trace amounts, often less than found in an apple or a common food that we might eat. These are minuscule amounts, and each component of the vaccine is tested for its safety in large-scale clinical trials. As a vaccine developer, I can tell you it can take decades to get all the approvals needed to pass all of the safety tests. So these are the most rigorously tested pharmaceuticals that we have. The third allegation, these conspiracies against the federal government, I don't know what to say about that. I mean, you know, one of the tenets of the anti-vaccine lobby is they claim that the Centers for Disease Control is involved in this massive cover-up, a conspiracy, that they're in cahoots with the pharmaceutical companies. You know, if you've ever spent time at a federal agency, you'd know that even if they wanted to engage in a conspiracy or cover-up, it would last at most all of an afternoon. Agencies are just not set up to hold secrets and conspiracies.
And finally, Dr. Hotez, can you tell us a little more about the book you wrote?
So the book is a couple of moving parts. It's a science book that does a deep dive explaining the evidence showing there's no link between vaccines and autism in studies involving over 1 million children. And it goes through the different assertions from the anti-vaccine lobby. At first, they claimed it was the MMR vaccine, and then that was refuted, and then thimerosal that used to be in vaccines, and then spacing vaccines too close together, or aluminum in vaccines. It's all nonsense, but, you know, I take the reader through this game of vaccine whack-a-mole where we knock down the assertions and they crop up a new one and we show that that's not the case. Also goes into what autism is and how it's a genetic condition that begins in early fetal development well before kids ever see vaccines. Then it tells a personal story of our family, of me, of Rachel, and her life, and she's very excited to be part of the book because she feels she's making a contribution. And the struggles that we face in terms of having her gain some meaningful employment or getting kicked out of a residential facility. And so what it means for a family now to have first a child, then an adult, on not just having autism, which is not so much of an impediment, but the fact that in many cases associated with severe intellectual disabilities. And that's really the big challenge for us. And we also tell the story of what it means to be a girl or woman on the autism spectrum. There's some unique features there because oftentimes girls and women are able to camouflage autism better by being more verbal or more socially interactive, but high rates of comorbidities like obsessive compulsive disorder or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Many of the teenage girls we know about with eating disorders, in fact, may be on the autism spectrum. So it opens up a whole new area of inquiry. So it's both a science book and a very personal story. In some ways, it's a unique genre. I haven't seen too many books like it.
Dr. Peter Hotez, I want to thank you so very much for taking time to talk with us today about this particular issue.
I really appreciate your giving attention to the topic and to the book.
That was Dr. Peter Hotez, M.D., a pediatrician, dean for the National School of Tropical Medicine, and a professor at the Baylor College of Medicine. He's also head of the Texas Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine.